Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Philosophy Society entitled Food, Environment and the Good Life. This talk is delivered by Professor David Cooper, Professor of Philosophy at Durham University, UK.
Good evening. On behalf of the Philosophy Society, I welcome you to today's meeting. I have the honor and the pleasure of introducing today Professor David Cooper. Professor Cooper has been president of the Aristotelian Society, the Mind Association, the Friedrich Nietzsche Society, and the Philosophy of Education Society of Great Britain. He is on the Executive Committee of the Royal Institute of Philosophy. Professor Cooper has been a visiting professor at universities in the United States, Canada, Germany, Malta, and South Africa. His philosophical interests include aspects of the history of philosophy, Western and Eastern. Indeed, he has written about Buddhism, for example, aesthetics, environmental ethics, and the philosophy of language. He has recently completed a book on the philosophy of gardens. His larger research interests include history of philosophy, Western and Eastern, as I said, aesthetics, and environment. Now, Professor Cooper is author of a great many important books. His most recent, I believe, book is A Philosophy of Gardens, published by Oxford University Press. It was published in 2006. 2005, a co-authored book, Buddhism, Virtue, and Environment. 2003, Meaning. 2002, The Measure of Things, Humanism, Humility, and Mystery, again by Oxford University Press. He is also well known for having authored the book World Philosophies, An Historical Introduction, and that was in 1996. To say a word or two about his most recent book, Philosophy of Gardens. In the book, he asks the question, very intriguing question. I'm not a philosopher, but I suppose it's a very, especially within philosophy, why do gardens matter so much and mean so much to people? It's something we take for granted, I think, but he asks it in a philosophical way. That's A Philosophy of Gardens, his most recent book. Today, Professor Cooper will be talking to us about a topic which I suppose would interest the Prince of Wales quite a bit, and that's food, environment, and the good life. I think we should think of it as part of his ongoing philosophical exploration of the interface between strategies of food production, the environment, and human well-being. So, Prince of Wales called the virtuous circle of interaction between food production, environment, and well-being. This has been an ongoing project for Professor Cooper.
Thank you very much for the introduction. So, the title is Food, Environment, and the Good Life. Now, at one level, there's a massive literature on the relationship between food, environmental issues, and human well-being. Ecologists, for example, study the effects of arable farming on sustainability and biodiversity. Other scientists investigate the effect of gas emissions from beef cattle on global warming. And so on. But at another level, I think the literature on food in relation to environment and human well-being is relatively modest or limited. In part, this is because the focus has been very much upon the production of food, on agriculture, to the relative exclusion of other practices involving food. The preparation of food, cooking, diet, and so on. And it's partly because the bulk of the research, ecological, scientific, has assumed a rather particular notion of environment. And I think this notion is in fact derivative from an older notion of environment that still informs everyday thought and talk, and I think is central to an important range of issues concerning well-being and the good life. So what I want to do in this talk, really, it falls into four parts. First, I want to explain the relevant notion of environment and of its relationship to that of well-being or the good life. Second, I want to indicate some of the historically important relationships of food practices to environment in the sense I'm going to be using that term. Then I want to discuss some of the ways in which, in developed societies at least, this relationship has been perverted or degraded, ways in which, therefore, well-being is itself compromised. And finally, and briefly, I want to discuss one or two proposals for halting or reversing the processes discussed in the third section. You can safely predict that ecologists, natural scientists, environmental ethicists, and so on, when writing about environmental issues, will keep referring to the environment. The dangers they discuss are ones to the environment. What needs protecting is the environment. And the definite article here suggests that there's just one environment, something very large and encompassing that all of us, humans and animals alike, are located in. Quite what the environment is identified with is often left vague. Sometimes it's equated with nature, or sometimes with the biosphere, sometimes with everything from the street corner to the stratosphere. But whatever exactly it's identified with, the environment is something very different from what was once understood by the term environment, and from what clearly still is understood by it. When, for example, people speak of a school or office environment, or talk about the atmosphere or the ambiance of a place. In this latter sense of the term, there's no single environment, but countless environments. Mine, yours, an African farmer's, a fox's, a codfish's, and so on. It's tempting to think that an environment, the foxes say, is just a small portion of the environment, a physically bounded space within a gigantic one. The environment, which contains all such little portions. But this would be wrong. Environments, in my sense, shouldn't be understood in physical or spatial terms at all. I mean, while a creature or a person is in an environment, this isn't the way that a pea is in a pod. The way is more akin to that in which a person is in, say, the world of fashion or in the world of theatre. It's not actually very easy to spell out this older sense of environment, to specify what constitutes an environment for a person or an animal. But here's an attempt. An environment is an environment for a creature. Something it's not simply in, but something it has understanding of. One's environment is what one knows one's way around, and in an unreflective, implicit manner. I mean, the geographer, with the help of maps, may know his way through the rainforest, but not in the manner of the woman who lives there, whose environment the forest is. An environment, however, is not simply something a creature knows and understands. It's what the creature engages with. Or better, the understanding of an environment is implicit in... the understanding of the environment it has is implicit in and constituted by intelligent engagement with that environment. The things that belong in the environment are encountered and understood in relation to the creature's practices and purposes, as things to eat, to avoid, and so on. And I think one could put all this by saying that the objects and places which belong in a creature's environment are meaningful or significant for it. And we could then characterize an environment as a field of significance or meaning for the creature whose environment it is. This makes it clear, I think, why a creature's environment can't be equated with what's more or less physically or spatially close to it. Some barely accessible outcrop of rocks a few metres from the fox's den will not belong to its environment, whereas the rabbit-rich field several kilometres away will belong to the fox's environment. My university belongs in my environment, even though it's much further away from my home than the housing estate I speed by on the train, which doesn't belong in my environment. I mean, these days, the field of significance, the environment, that jet travel, television, and other technological products open up for a person may be very large and scattered. Global cities like London and Tokyo may belong in the environment of a business executive in a way that the hills a mile away from his or her house do not. The environment scientists and ecologists talk about isn't a place any creature can be outside of, for any creature must be somewhere and not nowhere. Environments, in my sense, by contrast, can be lost by creatures, for creatures can be deprived of what they know their way about, engage with, and encounter as significant. The captured fox placed inside a bare laboratory cell is deprived of its, or perhaps any, environment, for there's nothing it understands there, nothing with which it can be at home. And we naturally speak of an environment being lost to us when the changes inflicted on our surroundings, by new buildings, say, render those surroundings strange. What was meaningful has gone, replaced by things and places whose significance we've yet to make our own. Well, this vocabulary of loss and deprivation indicates that the notion of environment I'm using as a field of significance is an evaluatively charged notion. An environment is something a creature ought to have. For any creature, if it's to live well, indeed if it's really to have a life, must have or be in somewhere it's at home, somewhere it understands, engages with, and which is replete with significance for it. The animal or the person deprived of its environment has been deprived to a greater or lesser degree of the conditions required for the pursuit of a life that embodies purpose, understanding, and a sense of the meaning of what impinges on it. The life deprived of or poor in environment is not at any rate a good life. So now the second section, which I've called Food Practices and Environment. The relationships between food practices, from growing turnips to dining at the Ritz, and environment, understood in my sense as a field of significance, these relationships are many and diverse. Any food practice could contribute to, reflect, or otherwise relate to that meaningful milieu in which a creature engages. So any general account of food practices in relation to environment would be impossibly encyclopedic. But it'll be useful, I think, to indicate some broad and important ways in which, historically, food practices have served to relate people and creatures to their environments, to shape or even create the fields of significance within which they move. In the case of most wild animals, the connection between food practices and environments is very tight indeed, and it's hardly an exaggeration to equate the animal's environment, the world it knows its way about, with its feeding habitat. It's not physical proximity that's the crucial consideration. That bare, hardly accessible outcrop of rock close to the fox's den is not part of its environment in the way that the more distant rabbit-filled field is. And that's largely because the latter, the field, provides food for the fox, whereas the rock doesn't. Of course, even as voracious an animal as a fox cares about things other than eating, about its young, for example. But no one, I think, would deny that the availability of food and the animal's manner of feeding are the main shapers of the animal's environment, of what it notices or ignores, is drawn to or avoids in its world. And even the manner in which it cares for and interacts with its young is powerfully constrained by its food practices. The relationships between human beings and their environments are naturally much more complex. Factors other than food practices, work, for example, structure what matters to men and women. Though it's worth recalling that there have been and still are peoples among whom work is itself a food practice, whose environments are scarcely less identifiable with feeding habitats than in the case of wild animals. One constituent in almost every creature's environment is its home, a place to sleep, find protection, and eat or digest food. Indeed, a home is an environment par excellence, a place where, more than anywhere, we know our way about and understand the significance of things and actions. The human home is a richer, more versatile theatre than the animal's den or nest. Nevertheless, the traditional home environment, like those animal accommodations, was powerfully shaped by food practices. Not only the layout of the home, pantry, kitchen, dining room, but the form of family life within it was structured by food practices. Meal times, both ordinary ones and special occasion ones, structured the daily and longer term life of the family, helping to cement or even define relationships within the family. Relationships further confirmed by the division of labour traditionally called for by food practices, bringing home the bacon, peeling vegetables, cooking, serving and carving. The contribution of food practices to the home and family environment was especially salient, of course, in the case of those homes which were also the sites of food production, the small family farms, for example, that are still the norm for rural households in many developing countries. Here, factors which also serve to shape home environments, work, weather, dangers, hopes and ambitions, are inseparable from food practices. The productive food practices of a family farm involve engagement with nature and serve to make environments out of the areas by which people are physically surrounded. For family farmers, but also for farm labourers, hired gardeners, fishermen, gatherers of berries and honey, it's their practical, purposeful engagement with natural life that constructs environments from the spaces in which they move and work. The point isn't only, or mainly, that what they do physically alters these spaces by, say, turning a patch of jungle into a vegetable patch. More crucially, what they do, even when the physical impact is slight, humanizes landscapes. It turns them into fields of significance. In one sense of that elastic expression, such activities promote oneness with nature. For the person who gathers berries and honey there, the forest is not simply a place to stare at or hurry through on the way to the next village. It's a place that enters into the person's life, a place one is at home in, a book of signs, as it were, of sounds, smells, and sights that are immediately and effortlessly understood. Typically, food practices are, or at any rate were, communal activities. I don't mean simply that they were conducted alongside others, people who might, after all, be casual day labourers or passing tourists in one's local pub. Rice harvesting in an Indian village, or a festa dinner in a Maltese village, are communal activities because they involve a community. People who know one another and enter significantly into one another's lives. The communities in which a person participates are an integral part of his or her environment. Indeed, one's understanding of just about everything in one's environment is, in a sense, public. It's an understanding one shares with and inherits from others. And as the German philosopher Martin Heidegger put it, each person's world is a they world, one always already interpreted for one by others. One central way, therefore, in which food practices may shape environments is by fostering, reflecting, or otherwise bearing upon communal relationships among people. And it's clear that historically food practices have emphatically done this. It's been argued, for example, that castes, kinship groups, and other communities may be partly defined in terms of food practices. A kinship group, for example, being one whose members share food with one another without hesitation. Or one thinks of the roles played in structuring and lending character to communities of such practices as communal harvesting, drinking and eating in local pubs, exchanging seeds and plants with neighbours. The communities and therefore environments that food practices help to define and shape needn't be local. For they can, as some geographers put it, be community without propinquity. The community someone belongs to may be far-flung. Indeed, a community of which one feels oneself to be a member, in part through sharing a diet, may be a diaspora, as with the Jewish community, or perhaps the veggie community. Well, here then are some of the important ways in which historically food practices, from growing produce to eating meals, have served to shape and stamp those worlds, those fields of significance of people and animals that I'm calling environments. They've served to shape home, relations to nature, and community. third part, which I've labelled food and environmental impoverishment. It's possible, as noted earlier, for a creature to be without an environment, in my sense, to be in no field of significance, to be alive in effect, but without a life. Think of certain animals in bare, featureless laboratories. And one reason, I think, for saying that these animals are devoid of environment is that they have no scope in such conditions for engaging in significant food practices, one central to the existence of animals who are leading natural lives. I mean, if the creatures in the laboratory are being force-fed or simply having pellets dropped down some tube, which they then ingest, then their eating is not a practice, not in the way in which it is with creatures living in the wild. Few human beings, fortunately, are so drastically deprived of an environment as this. But in less dramatic ways, they too can experience environmental impoverishment. Maybe there's nowhere they fully know their way about with unreflective ease, nowhere rich and replete in significance for them, nowhere they're at home. Those great themes of 20th century literature, anomie, alienation, disenchantment, these themes are, as often as not, themes of environmental impoverishment. And familiar announcements of the breakdown of the family, of the atrophy of community life and spirit, of disconnection from the land or nature, these are variations on those great 20th century themes. Food practices, we saw in the preceding section of the talk, can help to provide and shape environments, but they can fail to as well. They may, in the lives of many people, become irrelevant, so that for them, as one sociologist puts it, food becomes less significant, carries less symbolic weight than in the past, no longer, for example, providing occasions for family gatherings. Or food practices may even militate against the having of an environment, thereby compounding environmental impoverishment, by, for instance, turning a once rich and varied landscape into a featureless monoscape. This failure of food practices positively to contribute, as historically they've done, to forging and structuring an environment can occur in all the areas discussed in the previous section, those of home and family, of community, and of engagement with nature. Many observers of the contemporary way of food would endorse, I think, the remark of Sir Julian Rose, the environmentalist and organic farmer, when he speaks of such practices having contributed to alienation, not only the alienation of people from their means of survival, but from their fellow workers and therefore from society. And I assume there's some truth in this perception, in which case modern food practices or tendencies, the ones in question, fail to contribute to the good life, For a condition of the good life is having and engaging with an environment, a condition that is degraded by practices which contribute instead to what's rather nicely been called gastroanomie. The many food-related processes which might be accused of contributing to environmental impoverishment can, at a pinch, I think, be subsumed under two umbrella labels, which I'm going to give them, levelling and abdication. By levelling processes, I mean those which tend to homogenise food practices, to flatten out local and other differences among those practices. At the level of production, one thinks, for example, of the transformation of a once diversified agriculture into a monoculture, with a corresponding transformation of a variegated landscape into a monoscape. One thinks too of the increasing commoditization of agricultural produce, especially of what agriculturalists call appropriationism, which two of them define as follows: the persistent transformation into industrial activities of certain farm-based labour processes and their subsequent reintroduction in the form of processed food outputs. I mean, for example, if you eat chicken nuggets or turkey twists, your chicken nugget doesn't come from a particular chicken. I mean, what's happened is that thousands of chickens are minced up and turned into a sort of stuff contained in huge vats, and your chicken nugget is a little bit of that stuff, as it were, extracted from the stuff in a vat. And this would be a good example of the turning of agriculture into a certain kind of industry. These levelling processes of production can impoverish environments in a number of ways. And one way is by accelerating the tendency to what one writer calls place neutrality. A patchwork of diverse farms offering scope for a wide range of engaged activities gets replaced by a featureless landscape of cereal crops or gigantic poultry factories, indistinguishable from those to be found 100 or 1,000 kilometres away. And second, these processes can degrade the work environments of those who work in monocultural, industrialized enterprises. And there's an interesting study of Mexican workers who are sort of nowadays just shunted around between tomato packing plants in a region that's been entirely taken over by monocultural tomato growing. Whereas the, so to speak, fathers and grandfathers of these workers once, as it were, meaningfully participated in and had some control over agricultural production, their sons and daughters who were working in the tomato packing plants are described by the anthropologist who did this study as having suffered a spiritual loss, a loss of the knowledge that for millennia had maintained the land. Levelling processes are familiar as well at the level of consumption. I mean, in this connection, inevitably, one thinks of McDonaldsization, the inexorable spread of chains of barely distinguishable outlets serving the same food in the same surroundings. And, I think the contribution here to environmental impoverishment, one of the contributions, is once again through engendering place neutrality. By processes of abdication, as I call them, I mean those in which people hand over responsibility for food practices to faceless others, to biochemical experts, say, or the managers of the production lines that package the frozen dinners people thaw out at home. Like levelling processes, with which they're often intimately connected, these processes of abdication are visible at all levels of food practice. At the production level, they're at work in the ever-increasing reliance of farmers on high-tech machinery and chemical inputs, both of which substitute for traditional skills or know-how. And these processes are at work, too, in the appropriation of agricultural produce by industrial enterprises. For the farmer has then abdicated responsibility for growing anything that even remotely resembles what eventually gets eaten. You know, the farmer raises the chickens, but the chickens it raises bear very little resemblance indeed to the nuggets or twists that people later consume. The environment that was once shared by growers and consumers, a context of mutual understanding and reciprocal recognition of needs and benefits, has become, in many areas of the world, an environment of mutual ignorance. Abdication is evident too in food practices other than agriculture. I read recently, for example, that in the northeast of England, where I live, that 94% of the meals eaten by the families there took less than 10 minutes to prepare. Just one indication of the manner in which responsibility for the preparation and cooking of food has been handed over to faceless others. In this instance, the makers of instant, ready-made, microwavable dinners. And one can indeed see how food becomes less significant, of less symbolic weight, for people whose dealings with it, and one predicts whose manner of actually eating it, are so quick and casual. The preparation and eating of food in the homes of such people are no longer ingredients in a field of significance. They've become incidental, a mere means, one imagines, to topping up energy levels. And, you know, in this connection, it's worth remarking that, you know, in the United States, the UK, and so on, young people in particular have meals less and less. I mean, they graze. They eat on the hoof, picking up things throughout the day from delis or coffee shops. They don't sit down and have meals. Here, then, are some of the many processes subsumable under the headings of levelling and abdication, which mark the failure of modern food practices to perform the historic role of shaping environments, that is, of enriching the fields of significance in which people conduct their lives. And unless compensated for by practices of a different kind, the implication of this failure is that people's environments, and so to a greater or lesser degree their lives, have been impoverished. Well, what, if anything, should one try to do about this? What might halt or perhaps even put into reverse some of the tendencies I've just been describing? What we hear, I think, from a lot of writers who discuss these matters is a call for what for reconnection, and in particular the British agriculturalist Jules Pretty constantly reiterates the slogan, "Just reconnect." Of course, that slogan can be heard in different ways. But I think the way in which it's most often heard, and the way I think in which Jules Pretty primarily intends it, is as a call for connecting once again with the local. And it's worth, I think, remarking, how, again, in a country like the UK, just how unlocal most of the food that people eat is. It's estimated that the average food item consumed in Britain has travelled 2,000 miles. How better, the underlying thought goes, to resist the processes of levelling and abdication than to reconnect food practices with locality? So one's told, for example, that people should obey a so-called proximity principle. And this is the principle that as you travel around a country or even a continent, you should be able to tell where you are from the food that you're eating. And there are plenty of examples in the United States, Britain, and so on, of attempts to reinstate the local by way of a resistance to the homogenizing global, as two authors put it, vegetable box schemes, the eschewing of non-regional cheeses or of vegetables that are out of season and which will have to be imported if you eat them, or the Italian slow food movement's encouragement of local rootedness and decentralization in food practices. It's worth noting that, as those examples suggest, that I think there's no real consensus amongst champions of local reconnections on what exactly counts as local. I mean, how big is the where that you can infer you are from the food that you're eating? A country, a region of a country, a district of a region, a village in a particular district, or what? I mean, sometimes the call for reconnection is one for the resurrection of traditional national dishes. Sometimes, at the other extreme, for supporting one's nearest ice cream maker or village store. Most commonly, perhaps, it's one for protecting or reinvigorating the agriculture and cuisine of a region, with the ambition of promoting or recollecting a sense of region, since regions, as often as not, are partly identified in terms of their produce and typical dishes. But it seems to me that as a scheme for environmental enrichment, regionalist projects are very limited. I mean, for one thing, it's hard to see what impact they might have on the environments of city dwellers, living in places already too cosmopolitan to be much affected by the practices going on in market towns and villages of the geographical areas the cities happen to be within. For another thing, gastronomic regionalism is very easily, as we all know, commandeered for the global commoditized system that it's designed to resist. Supermarkets all over the country or the continent proudly sell the much-travelled typical products of a particular region. And most of the food associated with a particular region is likely to be sold and consumed not there, but in cities scattered around the world. Most importantly, it's obscure to me how, except for a few producers and retailers, how buying locally and eating some typical dishes and the like can significantly constitute or contribute to a way of life in the way in which food practices once did contribute. Such practices as eating local, typical, regional dishes, one fears, are really gestures at environments or ways of life already lost, rather than ways to shape environments and lives. I don't want to be at all opposed to calls for reconnecting with local, regional agriculture and food practices, but I mean, it seems to me that there are severe limits to how effective this is liable to be. And, you know, by way of conclusion, it's in a different set of practices, I suggest, that better prospects for environmental reconnection and enrichment may be found. And it's those which are involved in what we might call kitchen gardening, whether in private or communal gardens, and whether in gardens proper or in allotments. And these prospects, one likes to think, are recognised by the 500,000 families in the UK who, in a striking revival of the practice, now garden a lot, or by the many New Yorkers in the Green Thumb movement in that city of community gardens, and perhaps even by some governments, like that of Cuba, with its support of intensive organic urban gardens. That many communal gardens or allotments are found in cities means, incidentally, that the prospects for environmental reconnection afforded by kitchen gardening are not confined, as some regional initiatives are, to people living in the countryside. It'd be a mistake to subsume these practices of kitchen gardening under the label of localization, and to suppose that the problem with regional food practices is that regions are not local enough. For one thing, a communal garden or family allotment needn't be especially local. It may be further away from its users than the nearest supermarket. More importantly, talk of localization is a diversion from the main point, which is not the distance from their houses of where the produce they eat is grown, but people's active engagement with its growing and use. And several aspects of this engagement, I think, deserve individual mention, for each contributes to the shaping of environments, and thereby, it seems to me, to the good life. First, it's hard to envisage any activities which are available to almost everyone, which are more apt than kitchen gardening to engender a sense of communion with nature. For there are few forms of intercourse with natural things that require such intimate understanding of them, and perhaps none where there's such a degree of mutual dependence. Other things being equal, what's good for the gardener is good for what he or she grows, and vice versa. Second, kitchen gardening engenders a further sense of communion, this time with other people. Even in the case of growing food in one's own garden, the activity is rarely solipsistic. Seeds and plants are swapped with neighbours, vegetables and fruits exchanged as gifts, other people's plots visited and learnt from, just as they visit and learn from one's own. And in the case of allotments and community gardens, people are gathered into communities through their mutual interests and knowledge, as well as by their dependence on one another's cooperation. If kitchen gardening forges and shapes relationships to nature and community that are integral to environments, to fields of significance, so, third, it's apt to contribute to the environment's to the environment of the home. It's not simply that kitchen gardening typically involves the family as a whole. In addition, the preparation and eating of one's own produce takes on a significance and invites an attention that purchased, especially pre-prepared food, rarely does. The home is enhanced, becomes, one might say, more of a home when the preparation of food is an exercise of care and pride, and the eating of it a celebration of the fruits of the earth and of shared labour alike. What, in conclusion, I want to emphasise above all, though, about the engagement which kitchen gardening involves, is that it's indeed an engagement, a long-term, active and purposive commitment that's integral, not incidental, to a way of life, to one's world. Such gardening, if engaged in seriously, lends structure and regularity to a person's life, an intelligent, unruffled consistency, as Goethe put it, in doing each season of the year, each hour of the day, what needs to be done. It's not a hobby, a bolt-on extra to one's life, an incidental, indispensable decoration to the environment that's one's sphere of familiarity. For the demands it makes, the demands of a nevertheless voluntary dependence, to cite Goethe again, the demands it makes play a role in defining that sphere, in shaping that life and what is significant in it. And this is why the cultivation of one's own food is able, perhaps more than any other food practice, to return food to its historical role in constituting and enriching environments, in taking its place, therefore, within the good life. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you, Professor Cooper. Food for thought, I suppose, especially in a world where we get garlic from China, for example, in Malta these days. I thought about your call for sort of community-based food producing strategies that emphasize the small scale, etc. I think food companies are very much aware of this. In fact, advertising is very often aimed at producing the illusion of this. For example, in Britain, the Bernard Matthews turkeys, which come with a label showing a very old-fashioned, quaint turkey farm. In fact, we know that reality is not that. Or the Mulino Bianco biscuits and savouries that show you an old mill, presumably with a community attached to that, etc. But my question is, to what extent, when dealing with alternative agriculture, because you're really, I think, referring to alternative agriculture in a sense, to what extent will it always be just that? To what extent could we grow staples, for example, like wheat or rice in a kitchen garden?
There's probably a more general point behind your question, but in the case of rice, the normal form of agriculture in many developing countries would be very small village paddy fields. Mm. Rather than gigantic, thousands of square meters or kilometers devoted to rice. So I don't think it's true that. Of course, there are some economies of scale in having, as in the United States particularly, virtually whole states given over just to the growing of a single type of corn. It's certainly not necessary to do things that way, I think. Mm. I'm no expert on some of these sort of empirical matters about agriculture, but as far as I understand from discussions by many contemporary agriculturalists, that many of these economies of scale, which people went in for rather unthinkingly, it seems, and particularly in the 1940s and 50s. Mm. You know, a lot of this is now being reversed, I think. There is sort of a pressure in some cases for smaller units.
My question is, I mean, is it really being reversed, or is it just a kind of a leisure sector of the global food-producing market? Because we're often told that the only way of sustaining contemporary populations, the huge contemporary populations, 5 billion people and more, is by industrial methods of food production. What would you say to this?
Well, I mean, as far as I understand, that's just, I mean, false. the problem with, as I understand it, with food shortages is not, strictly speaking, there's a shortage of food. It's nearly always problems of distribution. And in fact, you know, a lot of these intensive industrial forms of agriculture actually add to the problem, don't they? Because if you have highly subsidized cheap corn, as for example in the United States, then this, and plus that in combination with free trade, then you're putting out of business people in developing countries growing on a much smaller scale. I think it's just, as I understand, just not true that you know, somehow the world would face starvation if one were to switch from some of these monocultural intensive industrial methods to others. That said, you know, I mean, you know, I wasn't standing up there trying to give a lecture on how to save the world. My point is that, you know, we've all got certain conceptions, I suppose, of what it is for human beings to live a good life, a flourishing life. Central, it seems to me, to the idea of a good life is that of having an environment that is a place that you engage in purposefully, meaningfully, and so on. And then I make the further claim that, you know, an important aspect, at least historically, and for some people, of the environment that is linked to the good life, food practices. And therefore, even if only a few people, even if it's only a very small number of people who engage with these food practices I'm recommending do so, then in the case of those people, it seems to me a contribution to the good life for them is being made. And there's no reason why you shouldn't try and promote that, even if you know that 99% of the population aren't going to bother.
I think we should call it an evening. Thank you so very much, Professor Cooper, for being with us and for a most interesting talk. And thank you all for coming.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Philosophy Society entitled Food, Environment and the Good Life. This talk was delivered by Professor David Cooper, Professor of Philosophy at Durham University, UK, and was chaired by Dr. Mark Antnifaltzon from the University of Malta.